Good afternoon. We're so grateful to invite you all to what is the winter quarter 2023 lecture of the David B. Abernathy Emeriti Lectures, subtitled Autobiographical Reflections. And our speaker tonight is going to be introduced by another special Stanford emeritus professor, Richard Popp, who was a friend and colleague of many of ours, was also Paul's mentor. And so he will be telling us a lot about Paul in a moment. A few words, though, about Richard before I do that, because he was a longtime cardiologist in the medical school, and then he was associate dean for academic affairs in the medical school. And all the while continuing to practice, and after he finished, he continued to do his teaching in Stanford's, Biodesign Institute. And that is an institute that I believe Paul was the originator of, so you'll be hearing more about it if you don't already know. So let me welcome Richard Popp, and you have a treat in store for you. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Iris. It's an honor to be here and to introduce Paul. Paul Yock is a pretty amazing fellow. He's a wonderful physician, clinician. He's been a fantastic teacher. He's an inventor, an educational inventor, and an innovator. He's done a lot of research in several fields. He's an academic leader and a visionary. Most important, however, he is a kind, gentle fellow who considers his students and his colleagues as family, really. Well, at Amherst undergrad, and then went over to England, to Oxford, and finally back to Harvard Medical School. He was the top of the class for all of those places. Finally decided to come out to UCSF on faculty in the medical school. And then we grabbed him back down to Stanford to be with us. As expected, he was an excellent clinician here at the Stanford Hospital. And he was especially interested in what's called coronary intervention, in which we're using catheters to open the coronary arteries, a field that's just ballooned in our lifetime. No pun intended, Paul. He was even acting chief of cardiology for a while, so he's done administration as well. But Paul has a special talent, which is to look at a situation and say, what's missing? And he did this a seemingly impossible thing for the school, in that for the first time ever, he developed a bioengineering program, a bioengineering department. The engineering school and the medical school had never had a joint department before. It had been tried before, but only Paul was the one who was able to accomplish it, and he was the originating co-chair of that department. Early in Paul's career, he saw the need to improve the way this coronary angioplasty was being done. He invented what's called the rapid exchange system for stenting, and it absolutely revolutionized the field. In the past, you needed at least two people to do a procedure on a patient. Paul figured out a way to use the equipment so that one person could do it. It was easier on the patient for sure, and it was also easier on the operators. Well, he thought this was a good accomplishment, but in fact, he was working on making things better for the patients and these opening the vessels. But he couldn't see inside to see what was going on, and so he said, I need to look inside the vessel. He invented what's called intravascular ultrasound. So he put an ultrasound transducer on the end of these little tiny catheters and was able to look at the blood vessels from the inside out. So he could see plaque, he could see what was going on in the biological process, and it opened up another whole field. Paul has over 50 patents with his inventions, quite an accomplishment. But one of Paul's most impactful contributions came in his belief that biomedical invention, as he had done, and innovation, could be taught as a discipline. And so he learned, I think, something from his friend David Kelly in the design school, and he developed what was then called the biodesign process. And it enables teams of medical people, engineering experts, and business specialists to work together to take advantage of the different talents, different backgrounds of the people. And the biodesign method is now ensconced in a second edition of a major textbook. It has several iterations online, and it's been translated into many languages. The biodesign approach has been replicated in dozens of academic units in the United States and around the world, using the textbook really as a template. Well, the original year-long biodesign innovation fellowship was started over 20 years ago, about 24 years, I think, Paul. And Paul and his colleagues now teach 5 undergraduate courses for 250 students each year. They even have a program for some of our own faculty to come back and learn this process so they can teach it and also exercise their curiosity. Paul has trained fellows, has trained faculty who come over to Stanford for 6 months at a time from other countries, from India, from Singapore, Ireland, Japan, Israel, and others. They take the biodesign process back to their own institutions and duplicate and further expand that. Now, the awards Paul has had, the honors given to him, are literally too numerous to relate here, but he's been honored in many medical societies. Paul's also a fellow of the National Academy of Inventors and of the National Academy of Engineering. The National Academy of Engineering sponsors 3 top awards, which are characterized as kind of the Nobel Prizes of engineering. And over the past 5 years, Paul has won 2 of these 3. The Rust Prize for Outstanding Bioengineering Achievement that Improves the Human Condition, and the Gordon Prize for Innovation in Engineering and Technology Education. Paul is the first person to win 2 of these coveted awards, and I think we're very pleased and very honored to have him talk. Paul?
Let's see if this is on good. After an introduction like that, I feel like I should just sit down and quit while I'm ahead. But thank you, Rich. Rich is the reason I came to Stanford for my fellowship 41 years ago. And this is a wonderful bookending of our professional relationship. So thank you again, Rich. Career timing mapped on to a really interesting set of events at Stanford and in the Bay Area, where we went from essentially no health technology innovation capability industry to the present day, where without dispute, this region is the top region in the world for health technology innovation. Thousands of companies within a 50-mile radius of where we're sitting, fundamental discovery. So I want to share that story with you from the perspective I had with a seat on the bus as that happened. And then Susan asked me also, I guess, in the way this series is done, to reflect a little bit on, you know, my childhood education, people who influenced me. So I thought I would start out with that and mention that I grew up in a suburb of Minneapolis called St. Louis Park, middle class. My dad was a clinical professor of dentistry at the University of Minnesota. My mom was a dental hygienist. And I would have told you that I had a very ordinary childhood and nowhere near privileged upbringing, and that would be hugely wrong. I had a schoolmate who made this point pretty adamantly, Tom Friedman. So Tom wrote in Thanks for Being Late a whole chapter on this little suburb of St. Louis Park, 50,000 people. He said in the book, "The Land of Oz that I speak of was the state of Minnesota. And for me, it's Emerald City was St. Louis Park, this suburb. Growing up in that community at that time was a gift of enduring values and optimism that has kept on giving my whole life." And he talks in this chapter about something peculiar that happened culturally in this little suburb. There was a diaspora of the Jewish community out of Minneapolis in the 40s and 50s with apparently an unwelcome environment there, settled in St. Louis Park, and fused with the Scandinavian community that was there at the time, and in Tom's telling, created an unusual culture with a heavy emphasis on education. And the school system was, in fact, terrific. And he points out in this chapter that over a decade and a half, there were a number of folks coming from this suburb that would turn out to be pretty prominent people in entertainment. So the Coen brothers, who made Fargo most famously, but also A Serious Man, which was set in St. Louis Park, this little community. Al Franken was in my year and left the public high school to go to a private high school. But he said, he reflected, we had a two-bedroom, one-bath house. I felt like the luckiest kid in the world, and I was. I was growing up in middle-class America at the height of the middle class, back when being in the middle class meant real security. It meant that if I worked hard and played by the rules, a kid like me could have the chance to do anything I wanted. Tom Friedman goes on to talk about, you know, a number of other luminaries. He missed one person, in my opinion, which was my older brother, who was a presidential scholar, so the top boy in Minnesota, and went on to have a distinguished career as a neuroradiologist. He was at Harvard, he was ahead of me, and, you know, burning up the place, and I said, you know, I was in his shadow, right, growing up the whole time. I was never the smartest kid in the room, which probably was a good thing for me, for prepared me for things like this afternoon. I decided to go to a small place.
Amherst College.
And I declared pre-med as a major, chemistry. But the good thing about the small place for me was I had a lot of peer pressure from my friends to not just be a pre-med wonk, to you know, take some challenging humanities classes. And I did that, and I especially fell in love with philosophy. And so I hurried up my chemistry degree, and my last year, my senior year, I just did philosophy as an independent study, and in particular, focused on medical ethics and medical ethics. I thought maybe there's a fusion here somehow of a medical career and studying ethics. And I had the chance to be an intern at this place, the Institute for Society, Ethics, and the Life Sciences that was in Hastings-on-Hudson, founded by Dan Callahan, who was really the father of medical ethics in this country. And I had a terrific experience here. And at the end of it, I had an exit interview with Dr. Callahan, and I told him, by that stage, I had a couple of acceptances for med school, but I told them, you know, I'm loving this reading and writing in ethics, and I'm kind of thinking maybe I should do that as a career. And we talked about it for a while. And at the end, I'll always remember this, he kind of looked over his glasses and he said, "Paul, I think you should go to medical school." Which I took as a reflection on the work I had been doing. But anyway, I delayed going to medical school for a couple of years. I had a Casby scholarship to study at Oxford. And you may know that at Oxford, you actually, they don't let you study philosophy only. You have to combine it with something else. So I read something called Philosophy, Physiology, and Psychology. And the regulation was you had to take exams, the final honor schools, in two of those three. So makes sense to combine philosophy and psychology, right, for philosophy of mind, or psychology and physiology for neuroscience, brain science. What I wound up doing was philosophy and physiology. And my thought was I really wanted to do the philosophy. I'd double down on that and then do just enough to pass the exams in physiology, which worked out okay. It turned out I was the first one in a lot of years that had done that combination. And there wouldn't be anybody else to do it for another 6 years. When a Canadian Rhodes Scholar did the same combination. His name was Mark Tessier Levine, by the way. So while I was at Oxford, I had the chance to have another good internship, which was at St. Christopher's Hospice in London. Dr. Saunders was the pioneer of the whole hospice movement, and this is the first hospice facility, and so I had a chance to spend a couple of months there. Loved the interaction with the patients, kind of reconfirmed my interest in going to medical school. And so I did that next. And to be completely honest, I did not have a good time, especially in the first couple years of med school. I'd been at Oxford wandering in the gardens and thinking great thoughts, and med school, was med school. When it came time to pick internships, I was kind of interested in getting out of that environment. And happily, I had a med school classmate who had grown up in LA and gone to Stanford. And she put her foot down and insisted that I at least set foot in California before picking an internship. And growing up in Minnesota at the time I did, we were a little suspicious of California. So I hadn't been. We flew out to LA one Christmas, and I looked around and I thought, my parents were right, this is evil. We came up to Northern California, and I was wowed. So a couple months later, interviewed out here. My interview at UCSF was in the chairman's office at the Fort Miley VA. Some of you may know this, it's perched up over the Golden Gate Bridge, and his office had this gorgeous view of the bridge and the sailboats and so on, and I was hooked. So I wound up there, and the person I would single out in terms of an influence, somebody Rich knows well, is Kanu Chatterjee, who just was an extraordinary master clinician. I've still not seen anything like this. And he had the effect that masters do of making the residents want to do what he did. So in my group, there were a number of folks he turned into cardiologists. The current FDA commissioner, Rob Califf, was a cardiologist. Eric Topol, I don't know if you follow Eric Topol, he's a popular media figure cardiologist, also in my group. So we had a lot of cardiology converts. But when it came time to pick a fellowship, I've already mentioned that I knew about Rich's work. Rich, for those of you who don't know, is a pioneer of the echocardiography, the cardiac ultrasound. He really worked out the practical way of understanding what's going on inside the heart with non-invasive techniques. So I was happy to get into Stanford. I was happy to be accepted to work in his lab. Learned an enormous amount of things. I'll reflect back a little later on that influenced me. But I wanted to highlight one other special person that Rich and I worked with, and that is a woman named Liv Hatley. Really interesting story. So Liv Hatley was a Norwegian cardiologist in Trondheim, Norway. And her hospital, not a especially big hospital, was just down the hill from the Norwegian Technical Institute, kind of the Stanford MIT equivalent in Norway. And there was a PhD student there who invented a different kind of ultrasound, one that could listen and measure blood flow rather than taking pictures. And he basically, when he finished his PhD, dumped that system in Liv's lab. She spent the next 8 years understanding the capability of this technology and completely worked out the way to measure pressure gradients and pressures inside the heart using this non-invasive technique. Before this, we had only been able to do it with catheters. So the problem was, as a woman in a not particularly well-known place in Norway, she couldn't get this published. And she self-published a monograph, which Rich and I saw. We looked at it together and said, if this is true, this is amazing. And Rich sent me over to Norway to try to figure out whether it was legitimate. Short story is, yes, it was brilliant. We were able to get her back to Stanford, have her work revalidated, published, and Rich got her the highest honor at the American College of Cardiology when he was president. So the story ends happily, but I don't know about you, Rich, but I don't know anybody else who was so far out ahead of the rest of the field as an individual. So I just wanted to mention her. My own career would be influenced in a different direction by somebody else, and that is this man, John Simpson. John was a fellow in cardiology in the 70s. And at one noon conference, he went to a lecture from a Swiss-German cardiologist named Andreas Grünzig. And Grünzig had the wild idea that we didn't need to do open heart surgery, that we could open arteries by putting a balloon catheter in and expanding it. John Simpson heard this lecture and was captivated and went to the chief of cardiology at the time and said, you know, I want to learn about this. This is fantastic. Chief of cardiology was a little more skeptical than John was. And John wanted to get some funding to go over to Europe to see this technique. Long story short, wasn't really supported, and he went on his own and wound up showing up in Dr. Grünzig's laboratory and in his kitchen where he made the catheters to see some of the first cases. And we actually have a recording of John reflecting back on that trip. It's a recording that we made in part of a new series. So many of you know about the Silicon Valley Archives. There's a wonderful collection of tech pioneers, Stanford and otherwise. But there hasn't been a lot from the med tech side. And so we're catching up. And over the past couple of years, have recorded some of these. The archives is now housed in a new facility, newly renovated facility in Green Library. Called Hobach Hall. And a nice little piece of small worldism, Harold Hobach was John Simpson's patent attorney who donated the center. So here's John Simpson reflecting back on this trip he made to see the early angioplasty cases.
The following day that I see the first balloon angioplasty with Martin Kaltenbach and Grünzig do this. the tank had already from 90% narrowing down to like 70. And I'm thinking, wow, this is absolutely amazing. So I saw several other procedures there. None of them worked perfectly, but all of them showed some improvement, let's say. But it also was apparent that his catheter was really hard to use. And that almost beyond grunting, nobody seemed to be able to make it really kind of work. And it did go through my mind even at that time. And I was trained by a radiologist named Lee Wexler at Stanford. And radiologists rely heavily on guide wires to position everything over guide wire first. And then, but Grunzig's catheter did not have a guide wire that you could move. And I thought, being trained by a radiologist, you know, we should have a balloon catheter that we're going to use in the coronary arteries. It should have a guide wire that we can move and so we can track in and out over this guide wire. So that was my contribution. And it did come out of an observation that nobody can make Grunzig's system work.
So it turns out Lou Wexler is here this afternoon. I lost him. Where are you? Over in the corner. So you know, look what you set out. So John came home from that trip, and he lived in Menlo Park. He didn't have a garage to do the typical Silicon Valley thing, so in his den, he constructed this catheter along with his colleague, Ned Robert. I'm referring for the podcast folks, I'm showing a picture of a catheter that's just a rough prototype. There also was not at this stage a med tech industry in Silicon Valley. There was, of course, a robust tech industry, had been since the late 40s of Hewlett and Packard. But what there was a infrastructure of engineers, lawyers, venture capitalists who were tech savvy. And all that was needed was a prompting to start the med tech industry. And John's invention and the company that he founded, Advanced Cardiovascular System, was really that spark. It became the granddaddy of the med tech industry in the Valley. Now, as I mentioned, thousands of companies, many startups in the area. John himself says that he would have liked to have stayed on at Stanford, but this work was still not supported. He did some of his first cases at Stanford, but he thought he could thrive better in a private environment. So he went up to Sequoia Hospital to join another Stanford refugee, Tom Fogarty. So Tom is somebody many of you know who worked with Norm Shumway in the early days of cardiac transplant surgery. Tom was a brilliant inventor, did a balloon catheter himself for clot removal. And he would have said then, probably still would say, that Stanford was not the kind of environment that could support his entrepreneurial spirit. And John Simpson felt the same way, joined Tom at Sequoia to begin in really the first big angioplasty practice in the Bay Area, and to continue the technology development. And this is where my story starts to intersect there. So I had the luxury of getting a leave of absence from my chief of cardiology at the time, Rich Popp, to leave Stanford and study with John Simpson as this new technology was being developed. The system that John was using was brilliant in that it was essential to use a guide wire to get to the right place in the heart. What was problematic is that the guide wire system was kind of klutzy. It was a very long, 10-foot long guide wire, and it required two proceduralists. It required the head guy, the John Simpson character, to move the balloon up and down. But there had to be a second person down at the patient's feet, actually, trying to control the position of the guide wire. And the problem was you had this 10-foot long guide wire. You had a tolerance of a few millimeters inside the heart. And if you lost that guide wire position, your name was Mud. That is, my name was Mud, as the assistant. And so I looked at that situation, and it dawned on me that maybe there was a different way of doing it. And as Rich described, developed this rapid exchange system. It's a little bit complicated, but the basic insight is that the balloon only has to be on the wire inside the heart for about 10 centimeters. The other 90 centimeters of the catheter, they can ride side by side, which means that one person can do the procedure, right hand with the guide wire, left hand with the balloon. And it just made it simpler, quicker. We shuttle balloons in and out. That's the rapid part of rapid exchange. So I made some prototypes, was able to demonstrate it, licensed it to John Simpson's company, and we went through animal testing and then began clinical trials in Europe, as was the case in those days. Another person of influence in my life was Cynthia Hawking, who ran the clinical trials for that procedure in Europe. And 2 years later, after these trials, in an uncharacteristic lapse of judgment, agreed to marry me. So the other problem we worked on in Simpson's laboratory was a big problem, and that was that these narrowings were coming back. After we dilated them with the balloon, they would recur in up to 40% of cases. And Rich alluded to this. I had the instinct that the angiogram that was guiding us just wasn't precise enough to tell us that what we were really doing inside the vessel. And if we could get inside and get a better look, that we would know whether we were doing a good job or not. And from my training with Rich, I understood that ultrasound theoretically was a good technology to try to get this better look, because it had the capability of seeing through the vessel wall. And so with the support of John Simpson, Tom Fogarty, we decided this was technically an ambitious project, needed a startup company. So we started up a company and did the development of the electronics and the catheters. And at one point, we're far enough along that we had been through the animal studies and it was time to do the first clinical studies. And this was my first time doing something like this. And I was naive enough to try to call up the FDA and find out. I did talk to somebody, and I was trying to find out, you know, how long basically would it take for us to get approval to do the clinical study? And you won't be surprised to hear that there wasn't a crisp answer to that. And about the same time, I called a friend of mine who had trained at Stanford and had wound up in Norway, cardiologist, and said, you know, we're having this trouble figuring out how to take this forward. Just out of curiosity, what would it be like in Norway? And he said, I don't know, we talked about something else. And then a couple weeks later, he called me back and he said, it's okay. And I said, what do you mean it's okay? He said, I talked to the guy in the government. He said, as long as the hospital approves it, you know, come on over. So packed up the catheters, went over to Norway and did the first clinical ultrasound. For the podcast folks, I'm showing an image right now, and you're not missing anything because it's a blobby, terrible to interpret image. And in fact, when I brought this tape home to show to Dr. Fogarty, he looked at it and he was quiet. And then he said, Paul, I can't see bleep in this image. It looks like a hurricane off the coast of Miami. Happily, the images got better and the catheters got smaller, and I'm this is a representative image now. I won't dwell on it. But I had moved to UCSF at this point, established a laboratory studying the ultrasound images and what we were doing with the procedures. And we were able to solve that question that we had, what was causing the re-narrowing. And the working idea had been that there was a heaping up, a scarring of the inner layer that's called intima, an intimal proliferation. That turned out to be not the major technique. It was something much more bizarre, which is the whole vessel was shrinking down. We were insulting the deep layers of the vessel, and it was girdling on down. Happily, at about the same time we were coming across this mechanism, there was a technology being tested that would solve that mechanism, and that is stenting. You've probably all heard about stents. These are little metal lattices that we now put inside the artery in a collapse form. We open them up, and they prop open the vessel, and they, by and large, solve this restenosis problem. The stents themselves had some issues in the early days, and in our lab we were able to work out that one of the issues was that they weren't being expanded enough. And the problem was the stents were clotting. Once you got them big enough, they didn't clot, and that meant that the technique could go forward. So I worked with some very talented people at UCSF with all of this. And the folks at Stanford got interested in this work. Victor Zhao, who was the chief of cardiology at the time, invited me to come back to Stanford to join Steve Osterley, who was head of the interventional lab. And I brought with a very talented young colleague who I first met in Rich's lab, was an engineer with Rich who went on to medical school. And so we set up a laboratory to continue these studies at Stanford.
Peter Fitzgerald
took over the laboratory. And I want to pivot the story a little bit at this point, because the main reason I was interested in going back to Stanford was that I had experienced something unusual in the mentoring I had gotten from Tom Fogarty, John Simpson, outside of Stanford, people who really knew how to take technology forward. And I was curious to see if there was some way of replicating that kind of mentoring within the university, because many of our physicians and a majority of our engineers want to go out and actually deliver technologies to patient care. And that involves really understanding the process of getting through the FDA and getting companies started and so on. So when I came back to Stanford in the mid-90s, turns out there was a group of faculty who had similar interests, a dozen or more folks who were either in engineering or in medicine, but were also gizmologists. And we banded together initially to form a group called the Medical Device Network, and did a series of classes for faculty and fellows, some of them sort of cheeky, like Patent Startup 101. This was at a time when the university was, especially the medical school, was a little uncomfortable about too much entrepreneurship. And that was a headwind that we had. Mainly we behaved ourselves and were able to get some traction. And the other key element was to pull in experts from the Valley. And some of those experts were Stanford faculty who had invented technologies, started companies. There are a number of these folks, a couple prominent ones who you may know, Rodney Perkins, who formed First Collagen Corporation, then went on to do 8 or 9 other subsequent medtech companies, ENT surgeon at Stanford. Bill New, anesthesiologist, who invented the pulse oximeter, the little finger thing that tracks oxygen. He made the first practical pulse oximeter, founded Nellcor. Number of folks like that who were willing to come back inside the university and teach and mentor. But the real turning point for us came when President Hennessy and colleagues announced that they wanted to form an institute that combined medicine, medical science, and engineering. That came to be called the BioX program and was housed in the Clark Center. Our group of gizmologists, seeing this opportunity, said, this maybe is our place, both physically and kind of administratively. Let's try to form a unit that's recognized for doing technology translation for medical purposes. And so we pitched the deans on having a unit of BioX that would be in a medtech vertical, combine, you know, education about translation. How do you actually get a technology forward into patient care? And then helping to mentor actual projects from the students or faculty. Now, at about the same time, as Rich mentioned, there was traction in getting a bioengineering department started. I'm going to only mention this briefly, but it was a question of sort of a phoenix rising from the ashes. There was a foundation called the Whitaker Foundation that made available hundreds of millions of dollars for universities that were willing to start new biomedical engineering departments. There were not many of those departments in the 80s and early 90s when the Whitaker Foundation brought this money online. Fast forward, they helped create 30 new departments of biomedical engineering. We were not one of them. So I co-led the failing effort for us to convince Stanford that it was time for a biomedical engineering department. We just weren't ready as a university for that. Jump forward to two new deans, Jim Plummer and Phil Pizzo, on the engineering and medicine side, who were very receptive to having a new department. John Hennessy felt strongly motivated, and we were able to get the gears moving to create a new department. Sadly, without the Whitaker money, but the story is still good. The department now is thriving. With respect to the story of translational technologies, which is where I want to stay, there was one important early development from the department. So when the department was basically just Scott Delp as chair and me, we were able to successfully get a grant from the Coulter Foundation, substantial grant, $20 million, to back faculty and student projects for technology innovation. And that really gave us the momentum to create an internal seed grant program to help that translational side of what we were doing. But we were also looking for an educational framework for technology translation in the med tech space, and we tapped into another powerful current at the university, and that was the design thinking group led by David Kelly. David, of course, had founded ID already, was in the process of spinning up the D school. Our program in biodesign happened a little before the D school, but he was pivotal in helping us think through how to have a educational framework for teaching. And the core insight of the design thinkers, as you probably know, is that instead of, you know, thinking up great ideas as a designer, you go to the users and understand what the users need. The trouble with our area is that the user matrix is this incredibly complicated set of stakeholders. So it would be lovely if we could design just for the patient-physician interface, but there are all these other stakeholders involved, and their priorities change depending on what administration is in. So it's a daunting job to design for the user, and for that reason, we developed a different approach that is a version of design thinking. It has three components for the folks on the podcast: identify, invent, and implement. Notice that inventing comes in the middle. It is not the first thing you do when you're developing a technology. You spend time with the needs. Try to understand what need is worth taking forward before putting the time and energy into inventing and testing the technology. That's the fundamental insight. We were able to lean on the experience of Josh Macauer, who is now the new director of the Biodesign program, folks from the business school and the medical and engineering school. And I'll tell you briefly how our teaching methodology works. So everything we do is in teams. The most intensive thing we do is a postgraduate fellowship, where we combine folks from different flavors of engineering and medicine. So one team a few years ago had a surgeon, a mechanical engineer, an electrical engineer, and a hematologist. And that group meets for the first time when they come to Stanford at the start of the academic year. And we put them into a different area of medicine each year. So in this year's group, we said, okay, you folks are kidney folks. You're going to go live in the hospital and work with the nephrology unit and talk to the nurses, talk to the patients, talk to the doctors. Don't come back to us until you see 200 needs that you might pursue with a technology solution. Now that sounds daunting, right? To come up with, that part is the easy part, right? Needs are all over the place. All you have to do is write them down. The hard part is figuring out which of those needs is worth 10 years of your life, tens of millions of dollars to pursue. So the exercise is to slow down at the need stage and screen. Consider multiple needs and screen down to the best ones. Screen based on, is it really important? What are the economics of it? What are the other competing technologies out there? That's the whole secret sauce of the program. We have a couple of mechanisms I won't dwell on where we slow people down at the need stage and make sure they really have a deep understanding of the need before it goes forward. Then, and this is 5 months into our process, our folks in a year-long fellowship spend 5 months on the needs before they invent anything. Then at that point, it's time to invent, and we give our fellows a guarantee. If you've gotten the need right, the invention is going to be the easy part. We feel pretty confident about that process, so we've been at this for a little over 20 years. And pretty much every year, the fellow teams come up with a substantial idea, and many of those ideas actually have gone forward to become companies. So at this point, there are 56 companies that have come out over those 20 years. They've raised in aggregate $1.2 billion, but much more important than any of that is that we tally up the number of patients reached by the technologies at the end of each year. So last year at graduation, 7.6 million patients had benefited from the technologies coming directly out of the program. But it's actually not the technologies that we care about. Our real product is the people who are trained in this process. And they go on to very interesting careers, academics, industry, big industry, startups. So we have 10 of our alums who are now on the faculty at Stanford in engineering and medicine. There are another couple dozen who are at other universities, seven of whom have started biodesign programs and lead them at their own universities. Interestingly, and we didn't see this coming, so we now have 30 of our alums who are CEOs of the companies that they've started. The reason I say it's interesting is that they are a secret weapon for us in terms of teaching and mentoring. So in our expanded class sequences with our fellowships, these are the folks with real-world experience who are helping mentor the students, and they bring, of course, an expertise that none of us within the university really have or are current with. Rich already mentioned the faculty fellows and the undergraduate and graduate classes. And we've been really happy with our global partnership. So we started in Ireland, then went to India to look at a low resource environment, then Singapore, and then Japan. Each of these programs were sponsored by their federal governments and have set up robust training programs with great outcomes that are similar to what I described for what we've seen in the US. We have emphasized creating educational materials mostly free. So we have a large video library of 300 lectures that are open source that anybody can use, and also a online textbook. So these, we've just recalibrated. These are used in hundreds of universities around the world now. And we were first kind of to do this, and so it's become sort of the standard that people use. I'll wrap up by just mentioning a couple of things that have changed, especially in the past few years as we adjust to the ever-evolving environment. The first is that our fellows are telling us, you know, you do a great job of getting us to a good idea, but the hard part comes after the good idea. And we've seen this with our faculty too. We have brilliant inventors on faculty, but the hard part is the next step. A great idea is not anywhere near good enough. You have to deal with intellectual property, regulatory barriers, reimbursement, and then the blocking and tackling of getting a business going. So happily, there are a couple of new things that Stanford is doing that I want to highlight briefly. One is a program called Catalyst. So the adult hospital, the pediatric hospital, and the School of Medicine have combined to create a program that provides pretty serious seed grant funding for the right ideas and provides resources for getting those tested within Stanford University. It's a relatively new program that the first tranche of ideas are going through, but I'm very encouraged that they're getting this right. The other thing within the health tech area is a partnership with a institute that Dr. Fogarty started. Dr. Wexler is a part of it, called Fogarty Innovation. These are folks who really understand how to get a company going. And so we send, every 6 months, we send two of our best faculty ideas over to the Fogarty Innovation Facility. They have 16 folks who are expert in all of those areas I just mentioned, who coach those projects, get them going on the right trajectory to actually launch. And then the final thing I'll mention is our efforts in the diversity, equity, and inclusion area. Our program, like everyone else, took a serious internal look with the events of the summer of 2020. I particularly noticed that George Floyd moved from Texas to St. Louis Park in 2016 and lived the last 4 years of his life there with some friends. So we undertook a serious look at how we were teaching and what the environment was like locally with respect to DEI. For our teaching, we noticed things like in the pandemic, it became clear that the pulse oximeter is not as accurate in dark-skinned people as it is in light-skinned. How did that happen that we didn't know that? And we have adjusted our teaching process to say to our fellows and students, at each of the stages in the process, you need to intentionally look at diversity issues. So when you're needs finding, do some needs finding in underserved communities. What are their distinctive needs? If you have an invention that you like, take the time to understand whether there's a difference in accessibility or even efficacy in a diverse population. And then finally, when you're about to do clinical testing, make sure that there are representative folks from underserved communities, that it's gender balanced, that you have a fair understanding of what your technology is going to do. That's on the teaching side. On the environment side, I've mentioned these thousands of companies. So we did a survey looking at what the gender and racial diversity was in our Bay Area MedTech network of companies. I went into that survey personally assuming that we were going to be better than tech. Yeah, you all understand that regular tech is terrible with respect to gender and racial diversity. We are no different within health tech. I was naive of me to think differently. I would say, though, that we have a deeper incentive than the rest of tech to be gender and racially diverse, because we're designing technologies for those patient populations. We need to have people of color, we need to have women designing technologies part of our team. So we launched a program called Diversity by Doing in partnership with the Fogarty Institute with the mandate of trying to help startup companies who God knows have enough on their plates just trying to survive with their diversity and inclusion efforts. And there are a number of parts of the program. I won't go into details. We just launched the Pathways in Health Technology program. I'll tell you briefly about that. So our premise is that we have a major pipeline problem that young people are not understanding what a health technology career could look like. And we've gone out to the local community colleges and asked them, find us talented STEM students who are from underrepresented groups who might be interested in a healthcare technology, and we will put them through an accelerated program introducing them to what the career pathways are like. And so we now have 30 of those students in our program. They are all in the process of transferring to a four-year college. They're all exceptionally talented, you know, great grades at their community colleges, and amazing life stories. I mean, these are folks who have battled to get to where they are in community college. So one example of the several programs that we're doing to try to address these vital issues. So I'm going to stop there. I'm happy to take any questions or comments.
Thanks, Paul. My question is, have you ever found a need that was really an important need, but you just couldn't solve it?
Yes. So
I'd like to know that sort of what and why.
Yeah. So to go into a little more detail, we usually advance three or four final needs into the inventing phase. And every time, one or two or three of those, we can't solve, the team can't solve it. So I can't give you one example because there are thousands of those examples. It's an interesting question. But the point of the process is you really do have to have multiple shots on goal in order to come up with that one that's going to actually survive. And it's frequently the case that you think you've got one that's surviving, and then something else turns up, and you've got to go back.
Thank you for a wonderful talk. You've identified a huge need, which is that the FDA is slow, bureaucratic, not responsive to you and other inventors out there. Having identified that need, what invention do you propose to deal with it?
So I have to say, first of all, that this is kind of like, you know, when did you stop beating whatever? The FDA is better than it used to be, okay? It used to be really terrible. And there's the head of the health tech branch, a guy named Jeff Schurin, has done a lot to renovate and make FDA better. And this is not a maybe sympathetic answer from the innovator standpoint, but I really think they are limited funding-wise. They just can't do the job that we wish they could do because they just don't have enough money to do it. That would be, if I could plunk a magic twanger, that would be what I would change. Having said that, there are smaller things to work on. The most important choke point in the system right now is actually not the FDA, but reimbursement from Medicare for something that the FDA approves. And that can take years and years and years. So if I were to try to focus on a pressure point, that's where I would go. And indeed, the new director of Biodesign, Josh Mankauer, is very interested in creating some policy changes and is setting up a new program to try to educate the government about what these issues are. It's a good question.
Given the interdisciplinary nature of, here I am, of your group, I'm wondering if you have any relationship with either the business school or the law school.
So we have a relationship with the business school, and we teach classes over there and have faculty helping out. I don't know if you're from the business school. In my opinion, the business school is thin with respect to healthcare expertise. Yeah. All right. We have not had a close association with the law school. There's a clinic, a patent clinic that they run that we've used. We have not come across anybody who really is in this kind of focused area of health technology law.
Excellent lecture. I really enjoyed it. Is there one invention in all the inventions that you have been responsible for which you feel has made the biggest impact?
Thanks for the question. So in terms of numbers, the rapid exchange system, that new angioplasty stenting system, is now up at about 50 million patients. So that's, in terms of how challenging the problem was, though, the intravascular ultrasound system was much harder, and I think it gave us more fundamental insights than the catheter system.
I'm curious. Certainly, some of the figures that you mentioned have become enormously wealthy. And so is philanthropy part of the background these folks receive? I know there is a program at the Biz School on philanthropy. So I was just wondering if it is a part, and if so, what sources you draw on?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'll answer it in a few ways. First of all, for our trainees, we are very intentional about saying giving back is, you know, part of your career trajectory, and try to imbue that idea. For the folks who have already made it big time, some of them are contributors to our program or otherwise in the form of fellowships. This is the biggest issue we have. Our program doesn't draw any funds from the university at all. And so we're constantly trying to fundraise to keep the lights on. So this was a thing that kept me awake at night for 20 years. So thanks for the question.
Again, thank you, like everybody else here, for this wonderful, wonderful, not a lecture, but a talk. And on a more personal note, you've had this fantastic academic career. Have you had time for any other kind of activities in your life? That's one question. And the second one, do you have children following in your footsteps, maybe?
Yeah. So I was a late bloomer from a life balance standpoint. I didn't get married until I was 40. I'm doing a little better now. I'm a sailor, and that's my main outside activity. Do have two sons. One is in finance, and one is a freshly minted biomedical engineer who is looking for a job right now, by the way. So.
Of the chair and ask you a question. Given our constituents and the fact that most patients in the hospital are in an age group that is not necessarily covered by the diversity as you described it, obviously we're very concerned about gender and race, but what about age and the problems of people, older people, especially in relationship to use of technology and how, and you mentioned Medicare being an issue. Can you kind of put that in the context of this?
Well, it makes me think of a couple of things. One is I do think that elderly patients are a diversity subset, and we explicitly do think about that as a patient group for access, you know, and all of the other reasons. So we have had in the past, we've done aging as a theme area. That turned out to be a challenging area for us because, honestly, there weren't the same business drivers for the solutions that we came up with. That's a problem in its own right. Same is true in pediatrics, by the way. So if you have clever ideas about that, we would be open to it.
Well, speaking of clever ideas, I thank you for this incredible multitude of wonderful ideas. And more than that, you've done something so important with those ideas. So thank you, and thank you for sharing your expertise.
Thank you very much.